This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our TV critic David Bean Cooley has watched a lot of television over the years, but one show he loved as a teenager, which was canceled after just 2 years, is the subject of his latest book, which is now out in paperback. David's book, Dangerously Funny, focuses on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, and he makes a powerful case for the show's importance in TV and pop culture history. The Smothers Brothers battled so frequently with network censors that CBS pulled the plug on the show in 1969. Tom and Dick Smothers gave a primetime platform to young writers like Steve Martin and Rob Reiner, to new bands like The Who and Jefferson Airplane, and to performers who opposed the Vietnam War like Joan Baez and Pete Seeger. David is the founder and editor of TVWorthWatching.com, and he teaches at Rowan University. He spoke with Terry about the Smothers Brothers last November.
David, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on the book.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Now, you've brought some really good clips with you from episodes of the Smothers Brothers TV series, and I'd like to start with one because I think it gives a good sense of the Smothers Brothers comedy and also how they managed to bring politics into their show. So would you introduce it for us?
Yeah, sure. I like this because it's a fairly early clip when the Smothers Brothers are still sort of considered to be, you know, just genial, nice folk satirists. And yet they're starting to hit on public issues and even attack the president in a very obvious way.
And this was President Johnson?
This is President Johnson at the time, yes.
Okay, so let's hear it.
Hey, Tom, you know, I just read in the newspaper this week where President Johnson has now asked Congress to pass a series of taxes, you know, to discourage people from traveling abroad.
Yo, What do you think about that?
I read it, too, but I don't think he has to go that far. I don't think that's necessary to go that far with
Well, look at it. It's a very, 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 very difficult situation. You know, people keep spending money abroad, and it's hurting our economy. People keep wanting to travel to other countries instead of staying here in the United States.
Yeah, well, I think President Johnson should come up with something positive as an inducement to keep the people here, something very positive. And
yeah, that's right.
As an inducement to keep the people.
That's good thinking, but look at what can the president do to make people want to stay in this country?
Well, he could quit.
David, was that considered pretty radical at the time?
Yeah, for an entertainment variety show, almost unprecedented, where you had these figures that were actually talking about public policy. TV in the 60s, the Smothers Brothers began in February of 67. At that point, almost all of primetime was trying intentionally to be as innocuous as possible. And so these guys were going against the grain.
And that's one of the things that makes the story so interesting. You know, it's the second half of the 60s. Youth culture has become the counterculture.
Mm-hmm.
Youth culture has also become, a lot of it, the anti-war movement. The country is, like, divided. People are going wild. And television is reflecting somewhere between very little and none of that.
Yeah, it's almost there are so many parallels to today that it amazes me. The whole country seems, you know, ideologically divided. Back then, it was a generation gap. It was you were either a hawk or a dove. You either supported the president or you didn't. And the Smothers Brothers came on, and at a time when there was one television in the house and everybody watched it, for the first couple of seasons, they pulled this amazing magic act and straddled the chasm of the generation gap. They had Kate Smith and Simon and Garfunkel on the same show. They had Mickey Rooney and The Who on the same show and appealed to both, you know, generations.
David, you know so much about so many different TV shows. You're just like a walking encyclopedia of television. Of all the shows you could have written a history of, why did you choose the Smothers Brothers?
This one, I wondered about that. This one, actually, I did once I was into it, and I was into like my fifth year of writing and my 10th year of writing. And I realized, I think this show, first of all, was at a pivotal point in TV history, that Tom Smothers fought for freedom of expression and fought for a whole generation and lost. And so TV changed and changed really significantly. And I argue that we've never gotten it back. I mean, the things that we think of as TV freedom, it's on cable or it's on late night, but in prime time, we've rarely had it since. And then the personal thing is that this show premiered when I was 13, and all of the stuff that was on there meant so much to me just because I was at that impressionable age and I was watching with my dad, and it was just a really nice weekly experience.
You mentioned you wanted to write this book in part because Tom Smothers fought and lost. And what he lost was the censorship battle. Mm-hmm. There was a considerable amount of censorship of the show. And he really took a stand, and he lost. And the show was taken off the air by the network, CBS. Let's talk a little bit about what censorship was like on TV then. And we're talking about the second half of the 1960s. What are some of the things you couldn't say then that you can say now?
Well, famously, when Lucille Ball was pregnant in real life and wrote it into her character in the 60s, she couldn't even use the word pregnant in the episode in which she was having a baby. They had to say it in Spanish, in Ciente. You know, I mean, it was so ridiculous. The censorship was so pervasive that even recounting it, it seems so silly. They cut an entire sketch with Elaine May because it was censors getting excited about the movies that they were censoring. And rather than cut a word or two, they cut the entire sketch.
Oh, and there was the phrase in it. What is it? I feel my heart beating in my breast, and they wouldn't let them say breast, so they ended up saying, I feel my heart beating in my wrist.
Yes, beating wildly in my wrist, yes. And they didn't even let that go.
They didn't let that go on the air either. All right. So, and drug references, you couldn't use those either.
Well, the drug references, if they caught them, they would take them out. But the 60s, things were so new that they didn't recognize a lot of them when they saw them. So the Smothers were able to slip some stuff by. And Tom actually enjoyed this battle a little bit, and so did Mason Williams, who was one of the writers. And so they would put in things that really meant nothing and instruct the crew and the writers and everybody around to laugh, like dirty, sniggering little laughs. And so the censors would say, well, you can't say rowing to Galveston. And they'd say, well, why not? And, well, you just can't say it. And so they would drive them crazy just for the fun of it too.
As an illustration of some of the things that were – of the type of thing that was censored, I want to play an excerpt of the show that you brought with you of Joan Baez dedicating a song to her then-husband, David. What was the context of this, both in terms of Joan Baez's life and the Smothers Brothers show?
Joan Baez, her husband at the time, David Harris, was going to prison for protesting against selective service and draft registration. And he was facing this prison sentence, so Joan Baez, in support, did an album of country songs and just recorded it. And so she went on the Smothers Brothers to sing one of these songs and dedicate it to her husband. She gave the dedication, which included the whole explanation of why her husband was going to prison, and CBS cut the explanation. So it was like, here's a song for my husband who's going to prison, and now green, green grass of home. It was just such an awful cut.
It's awful in part, too. It's not only, you know, a form of censorship, but also people might think that, you know, he'd like stolen or raped
exactly.
or, you know,
exactly.
done something at gunpoint.
Right.
What we're going to hear is the whole introduction, the unedited introduction.
Right.
All right. This is Joan Baez.
The next song is a song that'll be on my next album, which will be coming out shortly. The album is called David's Album. David is my husband. David's a sort of a California hillbilly. And so the songs on the record are all country and western, and it's a kind of a gift to David because he's going to be going to prison probably in June, and he'll be there for 3 years. The reason he's going is that he refused to have anything to do with the draft or selective service or whatever you want to call it. Militarism in general. And the point is, if you do that and you do it up front or overground, then you're going to get busted. And so, especially if you organize, which he does. So this song is called The Green, Green Grass of Home. In the old hometown looks the same.
That's Joan Baez on the Smothers Brothers show in March of 1969. And my guest is our TV critic, David Bianculli, who's written a new book about the Smothers Brothers called Dangerously Funny. So the show went on the air
mm-hmm.
in a truncated form.
Yes.
how did Joan Baez react to the way her introduction was edited?
She actually took it very well. What she did was she thanked Tom for the fight because she wasn't a network TV person at that time. And Tom said, well, come on, say whatever you want to say. So she got the opportunity to say it. They recorded it. It was the network who overruled Tom. And what she appreciated is that he did what he did so much of the time in the 60s. He ran right to the New York Times and to other papers and said, this was edited, you know, and this is wrong. And there wasn't a lot of that done back in the 60s. You know, there wasn't the whole tabloid culture. And so to have a guy from television come out and talk about his bosses, that was news then.
Perhaps the most famous case of censorship on the Smothers Brothers Show was Pete Seeger singing The Big Muddy.
Definitely.
So there's a prequel to that story. And that is that it's amazing he even got on TV because he'd been blacklisted. Because why?
He'd been blacklisted. He was part of the Weavers, and it was all the way back in Red Channels.
The folk group The Weavers.
Yes, the folk group The Weavers. And in 1950, his name was in Red Channels, which was this pamphlet that was putting out that was put out supposedly identifying people with communist leanings. So automatically, Pete Seeger is gone. And because he's so aggressive in his beliefs, he's off primetime for 17 years.
Well, he had also refused to speak to the House Un-American Activities Committee, which was investigating
right.
communists and communist sympathizers. And he declined to even take the Fifth.
Right.
So he was considered very hostile to the committee in that.
Yeah. You know. Everything that he did, I think, in retrospect, is so incredibly noble. But, you know, it was against the mainstream then. And so Pete Seeger is off TV, and the Smothers do this sketch that makes fun of LBJ, and President Johnson calls William Paley, the president of CBS, at 3 in the morning to complain. Paley calls in the producers of the Smothers Brothers to say, knock it off, take it easy on LBJ for a while. And the producers say, I don't know how Tom is going to take that. And Paley says, well, is there anything I can do if you do that for a while? You know, as sort of to sweeten the pot. They said, well, we've been trying to get Pete Seeger on. So let us have Pete Seeger. And Bill Paley says, he's on. And so that's how he got on.
I love that because in an act of trying to suppress speech, they let Pete Seeger in the door.
Yeah, it's very weird. And then the amazing thing is it doesn't stop there because Pete Seeger wants to do this new song, which is against President Johnson. I love the way it eats its own tail. And he wants to do Waist Deep in the Big Muddy, which has just come out on a Columbia Records album. So CBS Records says this is fine, but he tapes it for the Smothers Brothers to open the second season, and CBS says no. They let Pete Seeger come on, and he does three or four songs, but when he gets to his big finish, Big Muddy, they cut it. It's just not shown.
Now, we're going to be hearing, I think it's just the final verse
yes.
of this song. Set up what happens before the final verse.
Well, what happens is before the final verse – well, before that, this whole season goes by where Tom again goes to the Times, goes to other papers, and there's a change in our policy toward Vietnam, or at least our national feeling about Vietnam. So by the end of the season, CBS says you can have him back on and he can sing it. So this is actually from when he got to perform it and it was televised. So I think it's such a triumphant performance. But the song itself – is about a sergeant who is just taking
– Sergeant like in World War II probably.
Yes, in World War II, taking a troop on maneuvers and taking them to ford a river that he had before, but it had rained since. So what was safe now wasn't, and he was insisting that they go ahead and waist deep in the Big Muddy and then neck deep, and he was taking them higher and higher, and he drowns. You know, and the next guy in command says, turn back, this is a bad idea. Now, that's a pretty easy analogy to the Vietnam War. We could use it right now to Iraq or Afghanistan, but that was the message of the song.
And in this last verse, well, we'll play the last verse and then we'll talk about it. Here's Pete Seeger on the Smothers Brothers Show.
Well, I'm not going to plant any moral, I'll leave that for yourself. Maybe you're still walking, you're still talking, you'd like to keep your health. But every time I read the paper, them old feelings come on. We're waist deep in the Big Muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the Big Muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the Big Muddy, the big fool says to push on.
waist deep, neck deep. Soon even a tall man will be over his head. We're waist deep in the big muddy. The big bull says to push on.
So it's Pete Seeger in 1968 on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. And he never says the word Vietnam, but it's so clear he's talking about Vietnam there.
Yeah.
So you had described how this song was edited out of Pete Seeger's first appearance mm-hmm. on the Smothers Brothers. But he came back and actually did the song.
Yes.
And it was used, which is what we heard.
Yes.
So how did he come back and get to sing it?
They invited him back near the end of the second season. They were just... They kept pushing for it and pushing for it, and a lot of television critics at the time and commentators sort of said, hey. And so finally CBS relented and said, you can have him back. Around this time, Walter Cronkite had come on CBS and said basically the Vietnam War is unwinnable. So there was this whole change after the Tet Offensive that changed enough public perception to make CBS think, well, maybe it's okay.
The Seeger performance we just heard was in 1968. At the end of that year, George Harrison came on the show to support the Smothers Brothers in their fight for free speech on the show. And tell us a little bit about that appearance, and then we'll hear a brief excerpt of it.
Well, I love the whole Beatles-Smothers Brothers connection because in 1964, the Beatles show up on Ed Sullivan, CBS, Sunday night. It makes the Beatles. It makes the whole British invasion. It changes society. 4 years later, the Beatles have stopped touring. They're still the biggest thing in the world, and they've made this new thing called videos of Hey Jude and Revolution. And so for the United States premiere, instead of giving them to Ed Sullivan Sunday night at 8, they give them to the Smothers Brothers Sunday night at 9. You know, and that's basically saying attitudinally – we want to side with our generation. We want to be where the Smothers Brothers are. So at the beginning of this one show, George Harrison just shows up unbilled, a Beatle, just to show up on the Smothers Brothers.
Let's hear it.
Do you have something important?
Something very important to say on American television.
You know, we don't have opportunity of saying anything important because it's American television. Every time you say something and try to say something important, they clap, 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 clap.
Cue the lines. Well, whether you can say it or not, keep trying to say it.
That's what's important.
You get that?
Keep trying to say it. Yeah. That's what's important. Very interesting. From George Harrison to the Smothers Brothers. It's amazing thinking of having a Beatle in 1968, unbilled and unannounced. Mm-hmm. like people would be promoting that for days, weeks, months.
I know.
If they knew he was going to be on.
And you know how much I love the Beatles, so I love that clip.
Right, yeah. Right. Did that clip have any repercussions?
No. They were – but it's odd to me. After the show was – you know, after they were fired and the show was pulled off, Bob Einstein, one of the writers, says, how do you cancel a show or fire – you know, how do you get rid of a show that gives you a Beatle? You know, it is unthinkable. I mean, the talent roster that they had, one of the things I wonder about is that if the show had been allowed to continue a few more years with Tommy's eye for talent, I think he would have been Saturday Night Live. Except in prime time. He would have just had the best comics, the best musicians, and really pushed for social commentary.
In talking about how the network limited what the Smothers Brothers were allowed to say, you described some of the other barriers besides the people at CBS headquarters, some of the barriers that were put in the way. You want to talk about like the affiliates and the power that they were given?
The Smothers Brothers was the first show to be pre-screened for affiliates. In other words, to be sent a couple of days in advance so each affiliate could decide in its local market whether what the Smothers Brothers were doing on their show was acceptable.
And what did that mean for the Smothers Brothers production?
Well, it meant the most obvious thing is they had to have it finished sooner. And then – it was giving them a new layer of censorship. You know, Tom had this contract that said he had creative control, and yet the censors, you know, the standards and practices at CBS said, but that doesn't mean you can say or do anything you want. You still have to go through us. And so, but even if he goes through them, then a local affiliate in Boise may say, yeah, but I don't like you making fun of, you know, the president. That's just not right. And so what does he do? You know, is he going to not do a sketch because of an affiliate? Well, what he ends up doing is losing 15 or 20 affiliates that are no longer, you know, showing the program, which weakens the ratings.
You spoke to so many people for research for the book. Did you speak to any of the people who worked in standards and practices at CBS at the time and were responsible for making the decisions about what the Smothers Brothers were allowed to say and what their guests were allowed to say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I talked to, you know, among the people that I talked to, there was Mike Dann, who was an executive then. I talked with Bill Tankersley, who was the head censor for all of CBS for the entire period. He was a key interview, and it took me about 14 years to get him. And also Fred Silverman, who was just a young executive in CBS daytime then, but was allowed to sit in on all the programming meetings. But Bill Tankersley was the guy who sort of ruined some really good conspiracy theories.
How?
Well, you know, most of the people that are involved think that it's Richard Nixon that got the show pulled off, or at the very least, it was Bill Paley and it was Robert Wood, the new president. And what it really ended up being was Bill Tankersley and his group just setting down rules that they thought that Tom Smothers had to listen to. And when he didn't, they just didn't want to have an upstart that could, you know, because they were looking bad for the affiliates. They had promised the affiliates they would get a show by a certain day to preview for them. And if they couldn't do it, then they looked bad. The network looked like the Smothers Brothers were running things. And then what would happen? And so they drew that line in the sand. It was not a legal line in the sand, and the Smothers Brothers later sued and won. But that's what got the show yanked.
Yeah, so what got the show yanked was the network saying, oh, you failed to deliver a show on time. You didn't meet your deadline.
Right. And yet it was never a contractual agreement. It was just something that they said, you know, from now on, you have to do this because of the affiliate demands. But it was never a contractual demand.
And did the Smothers Brothers actually not meet the deadline?
Sometimes they didn't. Sometimes Tom would take the master and hide it.
Just to prevent the affiliates from judging it beforehand?
Or to prevent them from editing it before he turned it in at the last minute for the affiliate judgment. There was a lot of gamesmanship on both sides. I think of it as, in the 60s, you have parents and kids and they're just against each other, and they're both butting heads more than they should have.
So when you spoke to the person who was the head of standards and practices.
Yeah,
and was,
Bill Tankersley. Yes.
Tankersley, and was responsible for deciding what could be said mm-hmm. on the Smothers Brothers show. What did he tell you about the standards that were set and why they were set for what could and couldn't be said?
Well, oddly, he was more lenient than most of the people underneath him. Like, he had nothing to do with the Elaine May sketch being pulled, and he said, well, I saw nothing wrong with that. If they would have asked me, I would have thought it was fine. He had no problem with Pete Seeger. You know, his things were much more finite. But he was dealing with rules. But this was a guy who had been at CBS for so long. He had fought with, you know, George Burns, with Rod Serling, with Alfred Hitchcock, all the way back in the 50s. And so a young, just turning 30, Tom Smothers, this young little whipper, was not going to get the best of Bill Tankersley as Bill Tankersley saw it. And Tom would call him up at home, you know, on nights and weekends, and sort of plead his case. He drove Tankersley nuts.
Well, if Tankersley would have approved some of the things that you mentioned, mm-hmm. how come they weren't approved?
Well, he did approve some things, and they did – when they were asked, once Tom was able to go to the head of CBS on the East Coast, he didn't want to deal with the West Coast middlemen anymore. So it was just – and then Bill Tankersley was saying, no, you can't. You've got to go through channels. There's rules. Bill Tankersley was all about rules, and Tom Smothers was all about no rules.
So Tom Smothers wanted to bypass Tankersley, and Tankersley said you can't.
No, Tom Smothers wanted to deal only with Tankersley.
Oh,
figuring
oh.
You're the head guy. Let me just talk to you on the phone. Let me send this stuff directly to you. Tankersley did it once and then said, no, you know what? This is not going to work. We have the West Coast for a reason. and Tom just avoided them.
So is there one show you can point to that you think really did end the Smothers Brothers?
Certainly. It's the first time that David Steinberg came on as a comic and did a religious sermonette, a comic sermonette. It got more negative mail than anything in the history of broadcasting up to that point. And so the CBS censors sent Tom Smothers a memo saying, okay, you can have David Steinberg back, but no more religious sermonettes ever. So he invites David Steinberg back and even though it's not in the script, says, hey, how'd you like to do another one of those sermonettes? And so they add it in to the week's run through and he does it. He tapes it. That entire hour is never shown and the Smothers Brothers are fired very shortly thereafter.
So you actually brought with you a recording of the sermonette that was never aired.
Yes. Yeah. These are available now on you know, Time Life has the last two seasons out of the Smothers Brothers, the best of them. And one of the outtakes is this because it was never shown this whole hour. Back then, no one ever joked about religion other than Bill Cosby doing the Noah routine. And that was, you know, that wasn't about content. This was about content.
Okay. So let's hear it. This is David Steinberg.
That way he got into a ship that was commandeered by 23 Gentiles. A bad move on Jonah's part. And the Gentiles, as they're wont from time to time, threw the Jew overboard. Now here there are two concepts that we must deal with. There is the New Testament concept and the Old Testament concept. The Old Testament scholars say that Jonah was in fact swallowed by a whale. The Gentiles, the New Testament scholars, they say, hold it, Jews. No, Jonah, they literally grabbed the Jews by the Old Testament.
Okay, that's David Steinberg, and recorded in March of 1969, never broadcast on the Smothers Brothers show.
Yeah, there's a great story about that. When the Smothers Brothers sued CBS and went to trial, David Steinberg was called as one of the witnesses, and the CBS lawyers, you know, made him redo that very thing, and they cross-examined him and said, now, when you were saying New Testament, weren't you actually referring to testicles? Weren't you? And David Steinberg said, well, yes. Why were you doing that? Because otherwise it wouldn't be funny. And, you know, it's no wonder the Smothers won that case.
Well, the case was, again, that the network accused them of not delivering programs on time.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly what they were really worried about was the kind of content and language that was, you know, getting them into trouble.
Yeah, the big difference is that the Smothers Brothers were not canceled. They had already been renewed for a fourth season.
Mm-hmm.
They were fired. And so Tom was reacting, saying he was fired unfairly because anything that he had signed in terms of a contractual obligation, he had lived up to. That it was all these other little, you know, ephemeral things that they'd thrown on him, you know, through the years that he hadn't adhered to.
And is that the ground on which Tom Smothers sued CBS after CBS fired the Smothers Brothers?
Well, it's the one that went all the way through to the end. He wanted to go on First Amendment rights and really make this a huge case,
mm-hmm.
but he was advised by his ACLU lawyers, who were the only people who would represent him, that that would put it in a different court, it would make it a different thing, and so just go for this more narrow focus.
So he won.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Smothers won. But how long did it take him to win?
Well, the trial took a few months, but it was 2-3 years before the trial was on, and they won less than $1 million. But it stopped their careers. I mean, I liken the Smothers Brothers to, you know, when Muhammad Ali, you know, gets pulled, but he gets to fight again and gets his championship back after sticking out for his ideals, or Elvis goes away to the army but comes back and gets more number one hits. The Smothers Brothers were essentially done. They never had the power or the pulpit again the way they used to. And I just think that's a shame.
What do you think of as the, like, lasting effect of the Smothers Brothers show?
I think that it's most visible right now in places like Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and Saturday Night Live and Bill Maher. All of them are outside of prime time, but they're all sort of doing elements of what the Smothers did. Stephen Colbert tried very briefly to throw himself into the presidential race, just as Pat Paulson had. A lot of Jon Stewart's humor is very much what the Smothers was, and he admits that they were a very strong influence. Bill Maher says the Smothers were a very strong influence. And Saturday Night Live, I sort of see as what the Smothers Brothers almost had the chance to become.
Did the Smothers Brothers ask you to write the book? You allude to that in the acknowledgments.
One time after I interviewed Tom, he said, well, are you going to write the book? And I said, what book? And he said, well, the book on us, because I'd written in a previous book an entry on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, and I guess it was – he agreed with it. And so he said, I'll give you total access but total freedom. And as a journalist, that's just something you don't get. And so I said, well, I'll have to think about it. And then I waited 3 seconds and I said, okay. and he laughed. And then I remember him going down this very long escalator in Atlantic City, and he yells up at me just before he goes out of sight. He goes, I just want to read it before I'm dead. And that was 15 years ago. So I thank Tom for taking such good care of himself.
David Bianculli speaking with Terry Gross last year. David's founder and editor of the online magazine TVWorthWatching.com, and he teaches at Rowan University. His book, Dangerously Funny, the uncensored story of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, is now out in paperback. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. The clips we've heard, by the way, are from the Time Life video, The Best of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, Volumes 2 and 3. Dwight Twilley is a Tulsa, Oklahoma-born rock and roller who came to prominence in 1970s Los Angeles. His group, the Dwight Twilley Band, scored its biggest hit, the single I'm on Fire, in 1975, and then struggled for years to achieve stardom, but never quite got there. Now Twilley's back with a new album called Green Blimp. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
When Dwight Twilley staked his claim on pop stardom in 1975, he was already an anomaly. The Los Angeles to which he'd relocated from Tulsa, Oklahoma, was about to go gaga over melodic punk from the likes of the Runaways. The Sex Pistols in England and the Ramones in New York were seeking to disrupt the very mainstream that Twilley held dear. Like a pop version of John Fogerty, Dwight Twilley is his own kind of roots rocker, for whom the continuum in guitar-based music from the 1950s to the present remains seamless. It's sometimes hermetic, sometimes sealed off from innovation, but when he hits a groove in a fast song, or in his version of a power ballad, such as this one, You Were Always There, he really digs deep and gets traction on a song's emotion.
When I was down, you were always by my side. When I was save your darlings, but in the storms of night, I knew I was all right because of you.
The title song, Green Blimp, is an airy metaphor for the state of bliss and freedom from worry that the singer wishes to attain. With its sing-along chorus and mid-tempo harmonies, Green Blimp is Dwight Twilley's Yellow Submarine.
In the green blimp where I live, life is happy where I live.
Twilley has reached the age in his late 50s to have some regrets and some second guesses. There are times when he must look around at contemporaries such as Tom Petty, who sang background vocals on a few of Twilley's early recordings, and wonder, why couldn't I have gotten to where he did? It didn't help that Twilley's key collaborator, Phil Seymour, also a first-rate pop rock artist, split from the Dwight Twilley Band in 1978 and died in 1993. That's a terrific song on the new album called It Ends, that just builds and builds in intensity as it proceeds. Twilley invariably presents himself as a glass-half-full kind of guy. More importantly for the health of his music, he's not a cranky nostalgist. For him, the past is the past, which is the theme of one of the album's best songs, It's Never Coming Back, with its beautiful hammered keyboard opening verse. The current business model for pop music actually favors Dwight Twilley these days. Freed from the pressure of trying to get a major label deal, he's released Green Blimp as a download or in as-needed CD batches. He uses Facebook to raise funds for financing the album and getting the word out. Your little sister's outside playing jacks. Don't wanna spin the bar. Twilley has reunited with the original Dwight Twilley Band guitarist Bill Pitcock IV and gets some vocal assistance from Susan Cowsill. But Green Blimp ultimately sounds most like Dwight Twilley sitting in his Tulsa recording studio, hearing the history of rock and roll in his head, and doing what he's done for decades, shaping that history into hooks and riffs and passionately yelled vocals that convey the ceaseless thrill of feeling the freedom that remains the great promise of this kind of rock and roll.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Dwight Twilley's new album, Green Blimp. You can hear three tracks from the album at our website, freshair.npr.org. As a director, the 80-year-old Clint Eastwood isn't even close to hanging up his six-shooter. With more than 30 features under his belt, his latest is the supernatural drama Hereafter, starring Matt Damon. The script is by Peter Morgan, who wrote The Queen and Frost Nixon. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
In Clint Eastwood's Hereafter, three people in three countries have close personal encounters with death and subsequently find it impossible to connect with the living. And the film follows each character in turn until they finally meet. I won't say what happens when they do, but I thought of Gertrude Stein's unjust verdict on Oakland. There is no there there. Oh, there is a hereafter in the film, a life beyond this world. You see that in the first 10 minutes. But the movie itself is hung up in a kind of twilight zone, too mawkish and lame to make a decent ghost story, too contrived to tell us anything enlightening about how to live in the shadow of death. The film ends small, but starts really, really big, with a tsunami crashing into a Pacific beach resort and carrying off, among others, Cécile de France's French TV reporter, Marie. The sequence is fast, tight, and convincingly real. But when Marie gets conked on the head and stops breathing, she has a vision of the tidal realm. And it's dismayingly tacky and threadbare, a whitish void in which streaky human silhouettes stare into the camera. Yes, it's better than the other extreme, Peter Jackson's effects-heavy post-mortem playhouse in The Lovely Bones. But it suggests all the same that the dead have nothing better to do than stand around waiting for people to poke their heads in. Or for someone like Matt Damon's George to carry messages from one side to the other. George is Hereafter's second protagonist. He gave up a lucrative career as a medium, talking to the dead. But his brother, Billy, played by Jay Moore, continues to bring colleagues to see him.
Another person came to see me for a reading. Thanks to your friend, Mr. Andrio.
What? Look, I'll have a talk with him, make sure nothing like that ever happens again, okay?
And what?
Did you do it?
What?
The reading. Did you do the reading?
You still don't get it, do you? You think just because I can make money doing this, just because I can, that I should do it?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I also think you have a duty to do it because you have a gift.
It's not a gift, Billy. It's a curse.
When he communicates with the dead, George sounds like a typically bogus cold reader. He says things like, "I'm seeing a woman with dark hair, is that right?" But he's supposed to be the real McCoy, a man who can grasp someone's hand and see that tacky whitish void in which streaky human silhouettes stare into the camera. The third protagonist is Marcus, a working-class London boy whose twin brother gets run over by a car. Snatched from his junkie mom and placed in foster care, Marcus googles in anguish for someone to help him talk to his brother, preferably, since he's so needy, on a daily basis. That's where the movie meanders for a long hour, with Marcus trying to see the dead, George trying not to see them, and Marie wandering around visiting researchers, asking whether she saw what she thinks she saw. A scientist, played by Marta Keller, who claims once to have been an atheist, tells her, "The evidence is irrefutable." The evidence, of course, is thoroughly refutable. But you can be a card-carrying skeptic like me and still enjoy comedies like Ghost Town, or horror pictures like Poltergeist, or even sappy romantic thrillers like Ghost. Not Hereafter, though. Peter Morgan's script is credulous in the most simplistic, sentimental way imaginable. He says he wrote it after losing a close friend in an accident and longing to make contact with the other side. So he creates a world in which there seems to be some kind of conspiracy to keep us all from knowing the dead have messages for us, messages that boil down to forget about us and live your life. Good advice. It's a long decrescendo of a movie, directed in Eastwood's patented laconic style that sometimes works and sometimes, like here, is dull and impersonal. The solemn, guitar-heavy score Eastwood wrote doesn't liven things up, and neither does Damon, who's glumly self-effacing, until the bewildering final scene, in which George is suddenly able to see the future as well as the dead. Hereafter closed the New York Film Festival and has been hailed in some quarters as a masterly summing up of Eastwood's long career, which is kind of alarming. They're raving about him as if he's already given up the ghost.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.